Transfigurations by Victor Milan. November night wind whipped his trousers, stinging skinny legs like trifid tendrils as he shoehorned himself into a small club not far from campus. The murk throbbed like a wound, pulsing red and blue and noise. He stopped, hovering there in the door with the lumpy orange and green plaid coat in which his mother had packed him off to MIT 3 years before, hanging on his narrow shoulders like a dead dwarf.
"Don't be such a coward, Mark," he told himself. "This is for science."
The band lunged at Crown of Creation and wrestled it to the floor as he instinctively sought the darkest corner, teacup in hand. He'd learned how unhip it was to order Coke or coffee, at least. Other than that, he'd learned none of the moves in weeks of research. The way he was dressed in his high-water pants and pastel polyester shirt of the sort that always pooched out at the sides like a sail in the wind, he might have been in danger of being taken for a narc. This was the fall that followed Woodstock, the year Gordon Liddy invented the DEA to give Nixon an issue to distract attention from the war. But Berkeley and San Francisco were hip towns, university towns. They knew a science student when they saw one. The Glass Onion had no dance floor as such. Bodies swayed in crepuscular crimson and indigo glow between tables or crowded into a clear space before the tiny stage, with a whisper of beads and buckskin fringe and the occasional dull glint of Indian jewelry. He kept as far from the action center as he could, but being Mark, he inevitably bumped into everyone he passed, leaving a wake of glares and thin, embarrassed, "Excuse me's," behind him. His prominent ears burning, he had almost reached his goal, the little rickety table made out of a Ma Bell cable spool with a single dented green auditorium chair beside it and an unlit candle in an empty peanut butter jar plunked down on it, when he ran smack into somebody. The first thing that happened was that his massive horn-rim glasses slid down the ramp of his nose and disappeared in the dark. Next, he grabbed the person he'd bumped with both hands as his balance went. The teacup hit the floor with a crash and a clatter.
"Oh, dear. Oh, please, excuse me. I'm sorry,"
tumbled from his mouth like gumballs from a broken machine. He realized there was a certain softness of the person his skinny hands were clinging to so fervently, and a smell of musk and patchouli detached itself from the general miasma and drilled its way right up into his sensorium. He cursed himself.
"You had to go and run over a beautiful woman."
At least she smelled beautiful. Then she was patting him on the arm, murmuring that she was sorry, and they both bent down to the floor together in search of teacup and glasses, while the bodies went round and round around them, and they bumped heads and recoiled amid apologies, and Mark's fevered fingers found his glasses, miraculously intact, and fit them back in front of his eyes, and he blinked and found himself staring from a distance of 5 inches into the face of Kimberly Ann Cordain. Kimberly Ann Cordain, the girl, yes, of his dreams. Childhood sweetheart, unrequited, from the moment he'd first beheld her, pinafored and five, riding her trike down the modest suburban SoCal street where they both lived. He'd been so entranced by her Hallmark card perfection that the raspberry scoop fell off his ice cream cone to hot doom on the sidewalk, and he never noticed. She pedaled over his bare toes and cruised on with her pert nose in the air, never acknowledging his existence. From that day, his heart had been lost. Hope and despair surged up like surf within him. He straightened, his tongue too tied to pronounce words, and she yelled,
"Mark? Mark Meadows? Fuck, but it's good to see you!"
and hugged him. He stood there blinking like an idiot. No female who wasn't a relative had ever hugged him before. He swallowed spastically.
"What if I get an erection?"
Belatedly, he made feeble patting gestures at the small of her back. She pushed away, held him at arm's length.
"Let me look at you, brother. Why, you haven't changed a bit."
He winced. The taunting would begin now, for his skinniness, his clumsiness, his crew cut, the pimples still sprinkled across scrawny, allegedly post-adolescent features, and his most recent, most aggravating deficit, his utter and complete inability to be anywhere near with it. In high school, Kimberly Ann had evolved from indifference into his foremost tormentor, or rather, a succession of jocks on whose over-elaborated biceps she hung, cooing encouragements, had assumed the role. But here she was, tugging him toward that corner table.
Come on, man. Let's talk about the bad old days.
It was an opportunity for which he'd hopelessly hoped 3/4 of his life. Face to face with his paragon of love and beauty, while the band on stage assaulted the Beatles' Blackbird, and he couldn't think of one damn thing to say. But Kimberly Ann was more than happy to do the talking, about the changes she'd been through since good old Rexford Tugwell High, about the far-out people she'd met at Whittier College, how they turned her on and opened her eyes, how she'd dropped out midway through her senior year and come here, the Bay Area, the bright mecca of movement, how she'd been finding herself ever since. Perhaps he hadn't changed, but she most definitely had. Gone was the straight black ponytail, pleated skirts, pastel lipstick and nail polish, the prim stewardess perfection of an up-and-coming Bank of America executive's one daughter. Kimberly's hair had grown long, hanging down well past her shoulders in a great kinky, cloudy Yoko Ono mane. She wore a frilly peasant blouse embroidered with mushrooms and planets, a voluminous skirt tie-dyed into what reminded Mark of nothing so much as fireworks displays in Disneyland. He knew her feet were bare from having stepped on one. She looked more beautiful than he ever could have imagined. And those pale eyes, winter sky eyes, that had so often frozen him in the past, were glowing at him with such warmth he could barely stand to look at them. It was heaven, but somehow he couldn't buy it. Being Mark, he had to question.
Kimberly,
he began. She held up 2 fingers.
Hold it right there, dude. I left that name behind me with my bourgeois ways. I'm Sunflower now.
He bobbed his head and his Adam's apple.
Okay, Sunflower. So what brings you here, man? It's an experiment.
She eyed him across the rim of her jelly jar wine glass, suddenly wary.
I just finished my undergrad work at MIT,
he explained in a rush.
Now I'm here to get my doctorate in biochemistry from the University of California at Berkeley. So what's that got to do with this scene? Well, what I've been working on is figuring out just how DNA encodes genetic information. I published some papers, stuff like that.
At MIT, they'd compared him to Einstein, as a matter of fact. But you'd never catch him saying that.
But this summer I found something that interests me a lot more. The chemistry of mind.
Blue blankness, her eyes.
Psychedelics, psychoactive drugs. I read all the material. Leary, Alpert, the Solomon Collection. It really, what's the expression? Really turned me on.
He leaned forward, fingers plucking unconsciously at the felt-tip pens nestled in their plastic protector in his breast pocket. In his excitement, he sprinkled the spool tabletop with unconscious spittle.
It's a really vital area of research. I think it might lead to answering the really important questions, who we are and how and why.
She looked at him with half a frown and half a smile.
I still don't get it. I'm doing field work to establish a context for my research on the drug culture, the counterculture. Trying to get an angle on how hallucinogen use affects people's outlook.
He moistened his lips.
It's really exciting. There's a whole world I never knew existed. Here.
A nervous tick encompassed the onion's smoky confines.
But somehow I can't really, well, make contact. I bought all the Grateful Dead records, but I still feel like an outsider. I almost feel I'd like to be part of this whole hippie thing. Hippie,
she said with a patrician snort.
Mark, where have you been? It's 1969. The hippie movement's been dead for 2 years.
She shook her head.
Have you actually done any of these drugs you're trying to study?
He flushed.
No, I'm not ready to get to that stage. Poor Mark, you're so uptight. Looks as if I'm going to have my work cut out for me. Trying to show you what it is that's happening, Mr. Jones.
The reference skimmed his flat top, but suddenly his face brightened and his nose and cheekbones and whatnot went in happy directions, and he showed his horsey teeth.
You mean you'll help me?
He grabbed her hand, snatched his fingers away as if afraid they'd leave marks.
You'll show me around?
She nodded.
Great!
He picked up the teacup, flinked it against an upper tooth, realized it was empty, and clacked it down again.
I've been wondering why, that is, I, well, you've never, talked to me like this before?
She took one of his hands in both of hers, and he thought his heart would stop.
Oh, Mark,
she said tenderly even.
Always the analytical one. It's just that since my eyes have been opened, I've realized that everyone's beautiful in his own way, except the pigs who oppress the people. And I see you, still straight. But you haven't sold out, man. I can tell. I can read it in your aura. You're still the same old Mark.
His head whirled like a carousel out of control. Cynical, his left brain tossed up the hypothesis that she was homesick, that he was part of a childhood and past she had cut herself off from, perhaps too completely. He brushed it aside. She was Kimberly Ann, invulnerable, unapproachable. Any minute now she'd recognize him for the imposter he was. She didn't. They talked on into the night. Or rather, she talked and he listened, wanting to believe but still unable to. When the band took a long overdue break, somebody queued up side one of Destiny's new album on the sound system. The gestalt burned itself irrevocably in, darkness and colored lights playing in the hair and face of the most beautiful woman in his world, and behind it the husky baritone of Tom Marion Douglas singing of love and death and dislocation, of elder gods and destinies best not hinted at. It changed him that night, but he didn't know yet. He was almost too surfeited with wonder to be elated or even surprised when, halfway through the band's exiguous second set, Kimberly stood up suddenly, clutching his hand.
This is getting to be a drag. These guys don't know where it's at. Why don't you come over to my pad, drink a little wine, get a little high?
Her eyes challenged, and there was a bit of that old haughtiness, the old ice, as she pulled on waffle stomper boots with red laces.
Or are you too straight for that?
He felt as if he had a cotton ball sitting in the middle of his tongue.
No, I'd be more than happy to. Far out. There's hope for you yet.
In a daze, Mark followed her out of the club, to a liquor store with a massive sliding San Quentin grating over the windows, where a balding, pasty-faced proprietor sold them a bottle of Ripple under a gaze of fish-eyed distaste. Mark was a virgin. He had his fantasies, the Playboy magazines with their pages stuck together, stacked among the scientific papers under the tumble-down bed in his apartment on the fringes of Chinatown. But not even in fantasy did he ever dare to imagine himself coupled with the resplendent Kimberly Ann. And now, he drifted the streets as if weightless, barely noticing the freaks and street people who exchanged greetings with Sunflower as they passed. And he barely noticed on the rickety back stairs when Sunflower said,
"Meet my old man. You'll love him. He's a really heavy dude."
Then the words crunched into his brain like a lead mallet. He stumbled. Kimberly caught him by the arm, laughing.
Oh, poor Mark. Always so uptight. Come on, we're almost there.
So he wound up in this little one-lung apartment with a hot plate and leaky faucet in the bathroom. By one wall, a salvaged mattress with a Madras print coverlet rested on a door propped on cinder blocks. Cross-legged on the spread, beneath a giant poster of the beatified Che, sat Philip, Sunflower's old man. He was dark-eyed and intense, a black T-shirt stretched over his brawny chest with a blood-red fist and the word Wella lettered under it. He was watching clips of a demonstration on a little rump-sprung portable TV with a coat hanger aerial.
"Right on," he was saying as they came in. "The Lizard King has his head together. These clean-for-gene work-within-the-system aces like Turtle don't know what it's all about. Confrontation with fascist America. Who the fuck are you?"
After Sunflower took him off to one corner and explained to him, in a fierce whisper, that Mark was not a police spy, but an old, old friend, and don't embarrass me, asshole, he consented to shake Mark's hand. Mark craned past him at the TV. The bearded face of the man now being interviewed looked familiar somehow.
"Who's that?"
he asked. Philip lifted a lip corner.
"Tom Douglas, of course. Lead singer for Destiny, the Lizard King."
He scanned Mark from flat top to penny loafers.
"Or maybe you've never heard of him."
Mark blinked, said nothing. He knew of Destiny and Douglas. As research, he'd just bought their new album, Black Sunday. plain maroon cover dominated by a huge black sun. He was too embarrassed to say so. Sunflower's eyes went far away.
You should have seen him today at the demonstration, facing down the pigs as the Lizard King. Truly far out.
Amenities out of the way, the two of them broke out a contrivance of glass and rubber tubing, tamped its bowl full of dope, and lit up. Had Sunflower by herself offered Mark the grass, he would have accepted. But now he was feeling strange and alien again, as if his skin didn't fit him right, and he refused. He slouched in the corner next to a pile of daily workers, while his host and hostess sat on the bed and smoked dope, and stocky, intense Philip lectured him about the necessity for armed struggle until he thought his head was going to fall off, and he drank the whole bottle of sickly sweet wine by himself. He didn't drink, either, and finally Kimberly began to snuggle up close to her old man and fondle him in a way that made Mark distinctly uneasy, and he mumbled excuses and stumbled out and somehow found his way home. As the first light of dawn drooled in the windows of his own dingy flat, he regurgitated the contents of the ripple bottle into his cracked porcelain toilet, and it took him 15 flushes to get it clear again. So began Mark's courtship of Sunflower, nay, Kimberly Ann Cordain.
I want you, the word spilled across the wind, insolent, suggestive, the voice like molten amber with a whiskey edge, for all the New Year's noisemaker quality of the little Jap transistor.
Wojtek Grabowski pulled his windbreaker tighter over his wide chest and tried not to hear. The crane reared back like a zombie dinosaur, swayed a girder toward him. He gestured to the operator with exaggerated underwater moves.
I want you, the voice insisted.
He felt a flash of irritation. A blast from the past, 1966, and Destiny's first hit song, the announcer had warbled in his professional adolescent voice.
These Americans, Wojtek thought. They think 1966 is ancient history.
Turn off that boogie-woogie shit,
somebody growled.
Fuck you,
the radio's owner said. He was 20 years old, 2 meters tall, and 6 months out of Nam, Marine, Kaysan. The argument ended. Grabowski wished the boy would turn the radio off, but he didn't like to push himself forward. He was tolerated, a solid worker who could drink the strongest man on site under the table of a Friday night, but he kept to himself. As the girder came down and the crew swarmed up to fix it in place and the cold wind off the bay drilled through thin nylon and aging skin, he thought how strange it was to find himself here, him, the middle child of a prosperous Warsaw household, the small, sickly one, the studious. He was going to be a doctor, a professor. His brother Clement, half-envied, wholly admired, big, bold, dashing, with a cavalryman's black mustache, was going into the officer's academy, was going to be a hero. Then the Germans came. Clement was shot in the back of the head by the Red Army in Katyn Wood. Sister Katya disappeared into the field brothels of the Wehrmacht. Mother died in the last bombardment of Warsaw, while the Soviets squatted on the Vistula and let the Nazis do their dirty work for them. Father, a minor government functionary, outlived the war a few months before collecting his own bullet in the back of the neck, purged by the puppet Lublin regime. Young Wojtek, dreams of university forever shattered, spent 6.5 years as a partisan in the woods, ended them a fugitive, exiled to a foreign land with only a single hope to keep his blood beating.
I want you.
The repetition was beginning to grate on him. He'd grown up with Mozart and Mendelssohn, and the message. This was no love song. It was a lust song, an invitation to rut. Love meant more to him. A moment of cool moisture, sluicing across his vision, wiped away by the wind's chill hand. He remembered marrying Anna, his partisan girl, and what the Stukas had left of a village church, and afterward the priest himself had hitched up his threadbare cassock and played Bach's Toccata and Fugue on the organ, miraculously intact, while a starveling girl crouched to work the bellows. Next day they'd lie in ambush for the fascists, but that night. Another girder rose. Anna had left before him, smuggled out by helpful British operatives in June of 1945, bound for America with their child in her womb. He fought as long as he could, then followed. Now he dwelt in a land he loved almost as a lover. He had nothing else. In 23 years he had found no sign of the woman he loved and the child she must have borne. Though, sweet Mary, how he'd searched.
I want you!
He shut his eyes.
If I must endure that banal lyric one more time.
To die with me!
The music diminuendoed in an eerie wail. For a moment he stood very still, as if the wind had turned the sweat to ice within his shirt. What had seemed a mere syrup confection was infinitely more, more evil. Here was a man, anointed spokesman of youth, for whom the blandishments of love, or even lust, were degraded into a totentanz, a ritual of death. The girder clipped an upright and rang like a cracked bell. Grabowski shook himself, gestured the crane man to stop. At the same time, he strained, heard the announcer say the name Tom Douglas. It was a name he would remember. Mark hoped it was a courtship. 2 days later, Sunflower caught him coming out of a meeting with his sponsor and took him for a walk in the park. She let him tag along to the night spots and late-night rap sessions, to protest rallies in People's Park, to concerts. Always as her friend, her protege, the childhood friend she had made it her personal crusade to redeem from straightness, but not unfortunately in the exalted role of her old man. He found reason to hope, however. He never saw the studly Philip again. In fact, he never saw one of Sunflower's boyfriends more than once. They were all intense, passionate, brilliant, and at pains to tell you so. Committed. And muscular. That much of Kimberly's taste hadn't changed. That gave Mark many choice moments of despair, but deep inside his skinny bosom, he nursed the notion that someday she would feel the need of a rock of stability and would come to him as a seabird to land. But still, he never, never made it across the gap that yawned between him and the world he yearned for, the world Sunflower inhabited and personified. He survived that winter on hope and the chocolate chip oatmeal cookies his mother sent. And music. He came from a household where they sang along with Mitch and Lawrence Welk, occupied the same pinnacle as JFK. Rock and roll was never permitted to sully the air of his parents' house. He himself had been as oblivious to it as to everything outside of his lab and his private fantasies. He hadn't been aware of the Beatles' invasion, Mick Jagger's arrest for lycanthropy at the Isle of Wight concert, of the Summer of Love and the acid rock explosion. Now it all came rushing in on him, the Stones, the Beatles, the airplane, the Grateful Dead, Spirit and Cream and the Animals, and the Holy Trinity, Janis, Jimmy, and Thomas Marion Douglas. Tom Douglas, most of all. His music brooded like an ancient rune, dark, foreboding, hooded. Though his real affinity was to the gentler Mamas and Papas sound of an era already history, Mark was drawn to the Douglas touch, dark humor, darker twists. Even as the Nietzschean fury implicit in the music repelled him. Perhaps it was that Douglas was everything Mark Meadows wasn't, famous and vibrant and courageous and with it, and irresistible to women, and an ace. Aces and the movement. In many ways, they blasted into the mainstream of public consciousness flying formation, like the heavy metal warbirds Mark's father had led into battle over North Vietnam. There were more rock and roll aces than among any other segment of the population. Their powers tended not to be subtle. Some had the ability to project dazzling displays of lights. Others made extravagant music without the need of instruments. Most, though, played mind games with the audience by means of illusion or straight emotional manipulation. Tom Douglas, the Lizard King, was the head trip master of them all. Spring arrived. Mark's faculty advisor pressured him for results. Mark began to despair, hating himself for his lack of resolution, or whatever defect of manhood kept him from precipitating himself into the drug scene. Unable to continue his research until he did. He felt like the fly preserved in a lucite ice cube his parents had inexplicably possessed when he was a child. April saw him withdraw from the world into microcosm, to the paper reality inside his peeling walls. He had all Destiny's records, but he couldn't play them now, or the Dead, or the Stones, or martyred Jimmy. They were a taunt, a challenge he could not meet. He ate his chocolate cookies and drank his soda pop and emerged from his room only to indulge a nostalgic childhood vice, love of comic books. Not only the old classics, fables of Superman and Batman from the days of innocence before humanity drew the wild card, but also their modern successors, which featured the fictionalized exploits of real aces, like the penny dreadfuls of the Old West. He devoured them with addict's fervor. They fulfilled by proxy the longing that had begun to eat him up from inside. Not for metahuman powers, nothing so exotic. Not his craving for acceptance into the mysterious world of counterculture, nor the desire for the lithe, brawless body of the former Kimberly Ann Cordain that kept him awake night after sweaty night. What Mark Meadows desired more than anything in the world was effective personality, the ability to do, to achieve, to make a mark. Good or bad, it scarcely mattered. An evening toward April's end, Mark's retreat was shattered by a knock on his apartment door. He just lay there on his thin mattress, on sheets unchanged in living memory, burying his long nose farther in the pages of Kosh Comics Turtle number 92. His first reaction was fear, then anger at the intrusion. The world, he'd decided, was too much for him. He'd resolved to let it alone. Why couldn't it do as much for him? Again the knock, imperative, threatening the thin veneer of wood over emptiness. He sighed.
What do you want?
He edged the words with a whine.
Are you going to let me in, or am I going to have to smash through this papier-mâché thing your pig landlord calls a door?
For a moment, Mark just lay there. Then he laid the comic on the mottled hardwood floor by the bed, and in his dingy, tired socks, padded to the door. She stood there with hands on hips. She had on another 4th of July skirt and a faded pink blouse, and against the spring bay chill she'd pulled on a Levi's denim jacket with a black United Farm Workers eagle stenciled on the back and a peace symbol sewn on the left breast. She pushed into the room and slammed the door behind her.
"Look at this shit,"
she said with a gesture that bisected the walls at breastbone level.
How can a human being live like this? Living on processed sugar?
A nod at a plate of half-devoured cookies and a glass of brown soda that had been flat last week.
And wadding your mind with that pig authoritarian bullshit.
Another knife-edged gesture toward Turtle, lying in a crumpled heap on the floor. She shook her head.
You're eating yourself alive, Mark. You've cut yourself off from your friends, the people who love you. This has got to stop.
Mark just stood there. He'd never seen her look so beautiful, though she was berating him, talking like his mother, or, more correctly, his father. And then his skinny body began to vibrate like a tuning fork, because it struck him that she had said she loved him. It wasn't the sort of love he'd yearned and burned for from her, but emotionally, he couldn't be a chooser.
It's time you came out of your shell, Mark. Out of this womb room of yours. Before you turn into something from Night of the Living Dead. I've got work to do.
She cocked an eyebrow and nudged Turtle 92 with a booted toe.
You're coming with us.
Where? He blinked. Who?
Haven't you heard?
A shake of the head.
Of course not. You've been locked here in your room like some kind of monk. Destiny's back in town. They're playing a concert at the Fillmore tonight. My dad sent money. I have tickets for us. You, me, and Peter. So get your clothes on. We've got to leave now so we don't have to stand in line forever. And for God's sake, try not to dress like such a straight.
Peter looked like a surfer and thought he was Karl Marx. His looks reminded Mark uncomfortably of an earlier boyfriend of Kimberly Ann's, the football team captain who'd busted his nose in high school for staring at her too avidly. Standing outside in a threadbare tweed jacket and his one pair of jeans, breathing humid air and used smoke, he listened while Peter delivered the same lecture on the historical process all Sunflower's boyfriends gave him. When Mark didn't agree avidly enough, he could never make enough sense out of all these manifestos to form much of an opinion. Peter fixed him with an ice-blue Nordic glare and growled, "I will destroy you." Later, Mark found the line was a direct steal from the old man with the beard himself. Right now, it made him want to melt through the tired pavement outside the auditorium. It didn't help that Sunflower was standing there beaming at the two of them as if they'd just won her a prize. Fortunately, Peter got into a screaming argument with the cops who frisked them for booze at the door, diverting his wrath from Mark. Guiltily, Mark hoped the cops would slam Peter over his blonde head with a nightstick and haul him off to the slammer. But Destiny was concluding its most tumultuous tour ever. Tom Douglas, whose consumption of booze and mind-altering chemicals was as legendary as his ace powers, had been getting mean drunk before every show. The Lizard King was on a rampage. Last week's New Haven concert had culminated in a riot that trashed Yale's old campus and half the town. In their own clumsy way, the cops were trying to avoid confrontation tonight. Frisking wasn't the shrewdest way to go about it, but the cops, and the Fillmore management, weren't eager to have the kids getting any wilder than Tom Douglas was going to make them anyway. So the audience got shaken down as they came in, but gingerly. Peter and his golden head went unbusted. Mark's first Destiny concert was everything he might have imagined, raised to the 10th power. Douglas, characteristically, was 2 hours late on stage. Equally characteristically, so fucked up he could barely stay standing, much less keep from pitching off into the mob of adoring fans. But the three musicians who made up the rest of Destiny were among the tightest performers in rock. Their expertise covered a multitude of sins, and gradually, around the solid skeleton of their playing, Douglas's ramblings and inchoate gestures resolved into something magical. The music was a blast of acid, dissolving Mark's lucite prison around him until it reached his skin and stung. At the end of the set, the lights went out like the shutting of a great door. Somewhere a drum began a slow, thick beating. From darkness broke a tormented guitar wail. A single blue spot spiked down to illuminate Douglas, alone with the mic in the center of the stage, his leather pants glittering like snakeskin. He began to sing, a soft, low moan, increasing in urgency and volume, the intro to his masterpiece, Serpent Time. His voice soared in a sudden shriek, and the lights and the band boomed suddenly about him like storm surf breaking against rocks, and they were launched on an odyssey to the furthest reaches of the night. At last he took upon him the aspect of the Lizard King. A black aura beat from him like furnace heat and washed across the audience. Its effect was elusive, illusive, like some strange new drug. Some onlookers it lifted to pinnacles of ecstasy. Others it crammed down deep into hard-packed despair. Some saw what they most desired. Others stared straight down the gullet of hell. And in the center of that midnight radiance, Tom Douglas seemed to grow larger than life. And now and again there flickered in place of his broad, half-handsome features, the head and flaring hood of a giant king cobra, black and menacing, darting left and right as he sang. As the song climaxed in a howl of voice and organ and guitar, Mark found himself standing with tears streaming unabashed down his thin cheeks, one hand holding sunflowers, the other a stranger's, and Peter sitting glumly on the floor with his face in his hands, mumbling about decadence. The next day was the last of April. Nixon invaded Cambodia. Reaction rolled across the nation's campuses like napalm. Mark found Sunflower across the bay, listening to speeches in the midst of an angry crowd in Golden Gate Park.
"I can't do it," he shouted over the oratory din. "I can't cross over. Can't get outside myself." "Oh, Mark," Sunflower exclaimed with an angry, tearful shake of her head. "You're so selfish. So bourgeois."
She whirled away and lost herself in the forest of chanting bodies. That was the last he saw of her for 3 days. He searched for her, wandering the angry crowds, the thickets of placards denouncing Nixon and the war, through marijuana smoke that hung like scent around a honeysuckle hedge. His super straight attire drew hostile looks. He shied away from a dozen potentially ugly encounters that first day alone, despairing ever more of his inability to become one with the pulsating mass of humanity around him. The air was charged with revolution. He could feel it building like a static charge, could almost smell the ozone. He wasn't the only one. He found her at an all-night vigil a few minutes before midnight of May 3rd. She was cross-legged on a small patch of etiolated grass that had survived the onslaught of thousands of protesting feet, idly strumming a guitar as she listened to speeches shouted through a bullhorn.
"Where have you been?
Mark asked, sinking to the ankles in mud left by a passing shower. She just looked at him and shook her head. Frantic, he plopped himself down beside her with a small squelching splash.
Sunflower, where have you been? I've been looking all over for you.
She looked at him at last, shook her head sadly.
I've been with the people, Mark,
she said.
Where I belong.
Suddenly she leaned forward, caught him by the forearm with surprising strength.
It's where you belong too, Mark. It's just that you're so selfish. It's as if you're armored in it, and you have so much to offer. Now, when we need all the help we can get, to fight the oppressors before it's too late, break out, Mark. Free yourself.
Surprised, he saw a tear glimmering off in one corner of her eye.
I've been trying to, he said honestly. I just can't seem to do it.
A breeze was blowing in off the sea, cool and slightly sticky, occasionally shouldering aside the words garbling out of the megaphone. Mark shivered.
Poor Mark, you're so uptight. Your parents, the schools, they've locked you into a straitjacket. You've got to break out.
She moistened her lips.
I think I can help.
Eagerly, he leaned forward.
How? You need to tear down the walls, just like the song says. You need to open up your mind.
She fumbled for a moment in a pocket of her embroidered denim jacket, held out her closed hand, palm up.
Sunshine.
She opened her hand. A nondescript white tablet rested on the palm.
Acid.
He stared at it. Here it was. The object of his long, vicarious study, quest and quest's goal alike. The difficulty of obtaining LSD legally, and his deeply ingrained reluctance to attempt to attain it on the black market, along with his instinctive fear that his first attempt to purchase any would land him in San Quentin, had helped him put off the day of reckoning. Acid had been offered him before in hip camaraderie. Always he refused it, telling himself it was because you never could be sure what was in a street drug. Secretly, because he'd always been afraid to step beyond the multiplex door it presented. But now the world he yearned to join was surging about him like the sea. The woman he loved was offering him both challenge and temptation, and there it sat, slowly melting in the rain. He grabbed it from her, quickly and gingerly, as if suspecting it would burn his fingers. He poked it well down into a hip pocket of his black pipe-stem trousers, now so thoroughly imbued with mud they resembled an inept experiment in tie-dyeing.
I've got to think about it, Sunflower. I can't rush something like this.
Not knowing what more to say or do, he started to untangle his lanky legs and stand. She caught him by the arm again.
No, stay here with me. If you go home now, you'll flush it down the john.
She drew him down beside her, closer than he'd ever actually been to her before. And he was suddenly acutely aware that her usual blonde vanguard fighter was nowhere in evidence.
Stay here, among the people, right beside me.
She husked beside next to his ear. Her breath fluttered like an eyelash on his lobe.
See what you have to gain? You're special, Mark. You could do so much that really matters. Stay with me tonight.
Although the invitation wasn't as comprehensive as he might have wished, he settled himself back into the mud, and so the night passed in cold communion, the two of them huddling inside the dubious shelter of her jacket, shoulder to shoulder, while orators thundered revolution, the final confrontation with America. By early morning gray, the demonstration began to autolyze. They drifted together to a little all-night coffee house near the campus, ate an organic breakfast Mark couldn't taste, while Sunflower spoke urgently of the destiny lying in his reach.
If only you could break out of yourself, Mark.
She reached out and took one of his long, pale hands in a tan, compact one.
When I ran into you at that club last fall, I was glad to see you because I guess I was homesick for the old days, bad as they were. You were a friendly face.
He dropped his eyes, blinking rapidly. Startled by her open admission that she sought him out because of what he was rather than who he was.
That's changed, Mark.
He looked up again, tentative as a deer surprised in an early morning garden, ready to flee at the slightest hint of danger.
I've come to appreciate you for what you are and what you could be. There's a real person hiding beneath that crew cut and those horn-rimmed glasses and uptight establishment clothes you wear. A person crying to be let out.
She put her other hand on top of his, stroked it lightly.
I hope you let him out, Mark. I very much want to meet him. But the time's come for you to make the decision. I can't wait any longer. The time has come to choose, Mark.
You mean?
His tongue tripped. To his fatigue-fogged mind, she seemed to be promising much more than friendship, and at the same time threatening to withdraw even that, if he could not bring himself to act. He walked her home to the back stairs apartment. On the landing outside, she grabbed him suddenly behind the neck, kissed him with surprising ferocity. Then she vanished inside, leaving him blinking.
They finally taught them little commie fuckers a lesson. Right on, I say, right fucking on.
Standing to one side of the base of the skyscraper in progress, sipping hot tea from a thermos, Wojtek Grabowski listened to his co-workers discussing the news they'd just heard on the omnipresent transistor. The National Guard had fired into a rally on Ohio's Kent State University campus, several students known dead. They seemed to think it was high time. He did too, but the news filled him with sadness, not elation. Later, walking the beams up above the world so high, he reflected on the tragedy of it all. American soldiers were fighting to defend American values and rescue a brother nation from communist aggression. And here were fellow Americans spitting on them, reviling them. Ho Chi Minh was portrayed as a hero, a would-be liberator. Grabowski knew that was a lie. He had bled to learn just what communists meant by liberation. When he heard them hailed as heroes, his murdered friends and family rose up in a chorus at the back of his mind, crying denunciations. It just wasn't what the protesters stood for, it was who they were. Children of privilege, overwhelmingly upper middle class, lashing out with the petulance of the spoiled against the very system that had given them comfort and security unparalleled in human history. America eats its young, they screamed, but he saw it differently. America was in danger of being devoured by its young. They were led by false prophets, led horribly astray, by men like Tom Douglas. He'd read up on the singer since his song had so shocked him last November. He knew now that Douglas was one of the tainted, marked by the alien poison released that afternoon in September of 1946, a child of the evil new dawn whose birth Grabowski himself had witnessed from the deck of a refugee ship moored off Governor's Island. No wonder the children rose like serpents to strike their elders when they were counseled by men Satan had marked his own.
Hey, shouted the huge ex-Marine with the radio. Them hippie bastards are filling the streets down at City Hall, busting windows and burning American flags. The fuckers! We gotta do something. It's revolution right here and now.
The young vet pulled on his Levi's jacket and settled his steel hat on his crew-cut head.
It's only a few blocks from here. I don't know about you, but I am gonna do something about it.
He led a rush toward the lift cage. Grabowski would have shouted, No, wait, don't go. You must leave this to the authorities. If brother begins fighting brother, the forces of disorder will have won. But speech was denied him. Because he was as furious as the rest, and fearful. For he alone had seen firsthand the consequences of this revolution everyone talked about. And in his emotion, he had gripped a girder with all his might. His fingers had sunk into the steel as if it were the soft, sticky paste Americans called ice cream. He was himself marked with the mark of the beast. Mark passed the rest of the day in a strange haze compounded of lust, hope, and fear. He missed the word from Kent State. While the rest of America reacted in horror or approbation, he spent the night locked in his apartment with a plateful of cookies, poring through his papers and well-thumbed books on LSD, taking out the acid tablet, turning it over and over in his fingers like a talisman. When the sun was weakly established in the sky, a transient surge of resolution made him pop it in his mouth. A quick slug of flat orange soda pop washed it down before nerve could fail him again. From his reading, he knew acid generally took between an hour and 1.5 hours to kick in. He tried to slide past the time by flipping from the Solomon Anthology to Marvel Comics to the Zap Comics he'd accrued in pursuit of understanding. After an hour, too nervous to await the drug's effects by himself any longer, he left his apartment. He had to find Sunflower, tell her he'd found his manhood, had taken the fateful step. Also, he was afraid to be alone when the acid hit. Finding Sunflower was always like tracking a flower petal kicked about by the breeze, but he knew she gravitated toward UCB, which had long since replaced the moribund Haight as the locus of hip Bay Area culture, and she worked spasmodically at a head shop near People's Park. So, at about 9:30 on the morning of May 5th, 1970, he wandered into the park, and straight up against the most spectacular confrontation between aces of the entire Vietnam epic. For one brief, shining moment, everyone, establishment and enemies alike, knew the time had come for fighting in the streets. If the revolution was coming, it was coming now, in the first hot flush of fury following the Kent State Massacre. Bay Area radical leaders had called a mammoth rally that morning in People's Park, and not just the police forces of the Bay Area, but Ronald Reagan's own contingent of the National Guard had turned out to take them on. By 9:45, the police had withdrawn from the park, establishing a cordon sanitaire around the campus area to prevent conflagration from spreading. It was just the kids and several deuce-and-a-half trucks spilling National Guardsmen in battle dress and gas masks from under their canvas covers 40 meters away. With a loose, clattering squeal and diesel chug, an M113 armored personnel carrier pulled to a halt behind the line of fixed bayonets, shreds chewing at the sod like mouths. A man in captain's bars sat stiff and resolute in the cupola behind a 50-caliber machine gun, wearing what looked like a Newt Rockne football helmet on his head. Students ebbed from the green line like mercury from a fingertip. They'd been shouting to bring the war home, like their brothers in Ohio. It seemed they'd succeeded in doing just that. The guard was regularly called in to break up demonstrations, but the boxy, ugly shape of the APC represented something new. A note of menace even the most sheltered couldn't miss. The crowd faltered, buzzing alarm. Into the space between the lines, a single figure stepped, slim in black leather.
"We came to be heard,"
said Thomas Marion Douglas, his voice pitched to carry.
"And we're damned well gonna be heard."
Behind him, the crowd began to solidify. Here was a superstar, an ace, taking his stand with them. Across the bayonet hedge, the eyes of National Guard troopers flickered nervously behind the thick lenses of their masks. They were mostly young men who joined the Guard to avoid being drafted and sent to Nam. They knew who was facing them. Many owned Destiny records, had Douglas's haughty features staring down from posters on their bedroom walls. It was harder somehow to use bayonet or rifle butt against someone you knew, even if it was only as a face on a record jacket or in a photo spread in Life magazine. Their captain was of sterner stuff. He barked an order from the cupola. Tear gas guns coughed, a half dozen small comets arched down around Douglas and among the crowd surging up to join him. Billows of thick white smoke, CS gas, hid the singer from view. Taking a shortcut through an alley, Mark had managed to miss the police lines. At this moment he emerged to a perfect sideline view of his very own idol, standing with smoke swirling around him like a medieval martyr at the stake. He stopped and stared, open-mouthed, at the confrontation shaping up before him. The acid kicked in. He felt reality's collagens dissolve, but the scene before him was too intense for hallucination. As the stiff morning breeze tattered the curtains of gas, a man standing with legs braced and fists raised appeared. Auburn hair streaming back from a broad face that somehow flickered, interspersed with the head of a giant cobra, scales gleaming black, hood extended. The guardsmen drew back. The Lizard King was in their midst. The king moved forward in a sinuous glide. Uniforms gave way. Someone jabbed at him with a bayonet, or maybe just didn't back off quickly enough. A flick of the wrist, seeming lazy and disdainful, but delivered with superhuman speed, and the rifle went spinning away as its owner stumbled backward to the grass with a yelp of terror. The captain in his iron box shouted hoarsely, trying to pull together the fraying strands of his men's determination. But as he assumed his Lizard King aspect, Douglas loosed his mind games upon them. Their eyes began to wander, seeking visions of desperate beauty or mind-numbing horror, each affected in his own way by the Lizard King's black aura. The crowd was advancing now, chanting, shouting, menacing. The guard captain did the only thing he could. His thumb pulsed once against the .50 caliber's butterfly trigger. The gun vomited noise to bust glass and a Volkswagen flame, streaming tracers over the protesters' heads. Triumphant an eye blink before, the crowd came apart in screaming panic. The noise of the shots struck Mark like a giant pillow and spun him backward along endless twisting corridors. But the scene stayed before him, light at the end of a tunnel, terrible and insistent. No one had been hit by the burst, but the protesters, like Mark himself, had come up for the first time against the reality their prophet Mao had tried to impress on them, where power comes from. Tom Douglas was standing so close that muzzle flash singed his eyebrows. He didn't flinch, though the noise struck him with a force a truckload of speakers couldn't match. Instead, he met it with a roar of his own that sent guardsmen tumbling like frightened puppies. A prodigious leap, and he stood on the upper deck of the APC. He bent, grasped the gun's barrel, heaved. The heavy Browning came away from its mounting like a sapling torn up by the roots. He held the weapon above his head, both-handed, then with a single convulsion of shoulders and biceps, bent the barrel almost double. Having displayed his contempt for the establishment and its war machines, he tossed the ruined machine gun after the troopers, now in full rout, and bent forward to pluck the now terror-stricken captain from the cupola by the front of his blouse. He held the man up before him, legs kicking feebly, and was struck down from behind by a blow driven with the full, awesome strength of an unknown ace. Mark snapped. With a shriek, his soul vanished into swirling dark. His body turned and blindly ran. Wojtek Grabowski saw the sinister serpent figure in black leap onto the APC and tear the weapon from its mountings, and knew it had been the right choice to live. Only devout Catholicism had stopped him from throwing himself to his death. He'd hurried from the site, already deserted as the workers rushed to attack the demonstrators, and home to his cramped apartment to a night-long vigil of misery and silent prayer. With dawn had indeed come light, and he knew with a warm rush that his ace affliction was divinely sent, a blessing, not a curse. Revolution threatened his adopted home, led by those who'd sworn allegiance to the forces of darkness. He had washed, dressed, made his own way to the park with peace in his heart. Now he was confronted with a beast that seemed to have many heads, and knew that he was face to face with the hated Tom Douglas himself. Fury blasted into him. The ace transformation overtook him, bulking his muscles hugely to fill his baggy clothes to the bursting point. The steel hat of his profession was on his head, a yard-long pipefitter's wrench in his hand. Lingering doubts about using his strength against normal humans vanished. Here was an enemy worthy of him, an ace, a traitor, a servitor of hell. He raced forward, vaulted onto the vehicle even as the snake-headed creature in black plucked its commander from the hatch. Students cried warnings Douglas didn't hear. Hard Hat raised his wrench and struck at the back of a head now bushy-haired, now black and glabrous and obscene. The blow would have pulped the skull of a normal man, or torn his head from his shoulders, but the constant shifting of Douglas's appearance confused Grabowski's aim. The blow glanced off. Douglas dropped the squirming officer and slumped bonelessly off the vehicle as momentum carried the wrench downward to buckle the aluminum top armor like tinfoil. Thinking he had killed him, Grabowski felt strength ebb. He needed rage to stay in the metastate, but all he felt was shame. Desperate, he turned to face the crowd.
"Go home,"
he shouted in his hoarse, harsh English.
"Go home now. It's over. You must not fight no more. Obey your leaders and live in peace."
They stood and stared at him with sheep's faces. Morning dew had sucked the tear gas down into it and poisoned the grass. A few white CS tendrils writhed on the ground like dying snakes. Tears streamed down Grabowski's face. Wouldn't they listen? From the rear of the crowd, a young man shouted,
"Fuck you! Fuck you, you motherfucking fascist!"
To have that epithet thrown at him, a man who still carried fascist bullets in his flesh, by some spoiled, insolent, ignorant puppy. Anger filled him in abundance, and with it, that inhuman strength. Fortunately for him, because about then Tom Douglas got his wits back, jumped to his feet, grabbed the hard hat by the ankles, and yanked his boots out from under him. Grabowski's helmet struck the deck like a giant cymbal. Every bit as furious as the man who'd taken him down, Douglas caught him as he fell, slammed him against the side of the vehicle, and began to pile-drive blows into him with his own ace strength. But Grabowski, too, had more than human durability. He dragged his wrench up between their bodies, thrust Douglas violently away. Douglas's feet slipped once on the wet grass. He caught himself with serpent agility and lunged forward to the attack, only to check himself and go up on tiptoe like a ballet dancer, while a savage two-handed swipe of the wrench whined within an inch of his abdomen. Douglas dove inside the wrench's deadly arc. He grappled his opponent, slamming punches in under the short ribs. Grabowski took a quick step backward, put a hand on Douglas's sternum, and pushed. Douglas fell back a step. The wrench lashed out, and this time only Douglas's metahuman reflexes saved him from catching it square in the front of his skull. The tool's steel beak raked his forehead. Blood cascaded. He backpedaled furiously, wiping his eyes with one hand while the other thrashed about in an attempt to ward the following blow. Hardhat swung his wrench like a baseball bat and took Douglas under the right arm with a sound that echoed through the park like a grenade explosion. Douglas went down. Hardhat stood over him with legs spread wide, raising the wrench slowly above his head like a headsman preparing the stroke. Blood drooled from the corner of his mouth. He was berserk, beyond compunction, beyond compassion, devoid of anything but the need to smash his opponent's skull like a snail on a rock. But even as the gleaming, blood-dripping wrench started down, a golden chain wrapped around it from behind and stopped the blow before it was launched. With a fighter's reflex, Hardhat instantly relaxed his arms, allowing his wrench to travel in the direction the sudden restraint pulled. Then he snapped the weapon forward and down, spinning as he did so to throw the entire augmented weight of his body against the slack. But as he moved, a Houlihan rippled down the chain and it loosened, so that the wrench slithered free with a musical sound. Motion unchecked by expected impact, Hardhat spun around completely, staggering forward, continued through another half-turn so that he faced his opponent across 5 meters of muddy, trampled earth. A youth stood there, slender and tall, golden hair falling to his shoulders, dangling a saucer-sized peace medallion of gold on a long chain. Despite Bay morning chill, he wore only a pair of jeans. To the short, dark Grabowski, he looked like nothing so much as a figure stepped from a Nazi recruiting poster.
"Who are you?"
Hardhat snarled. Then, realizing he had spoken in his own tongue, repeated it in English. The youth frowned briefly, as if perplexed.
"Call me Radical," he said then with a grin. "I'm here to protect the people."
"Traitor!"
Hardhat launched himself, swinging the wrench. Radical danced aside. No matter how savagely Hardhat attacked, no matter how he fainted, his opponent eluded him with apparent ease. Frustrated at his attempts to strike the golden youth, Hardhat turned once again to Douglas, still moaning on the ground. And Radical was there, peace symbol weaving a golden figure of eight in the air before him, warding Hardhat's most ferocious blows with sparks of coruscance, while soldiers and students alike stood transfixed by the spectacle. But if Hardhat couldn't strike past the amulet, Radical seemed unwilling or unable to counterattack. Noting this, Hardhat backed away, waving his wrench menacingly. After a moment, Radical followed, flowing like mist. Hardhat circled Widdershins. Radical kept pace. Slowly the pole drew his long-haired opponent away from the recumbent Douglas. Lightning fast, he wheeled left and hurled himself at the onlookers. Though his speed wasn't as great as Radical's, it was greater than Enorm's, and he was among the crowd of protesters before any could react, wrench upraised to smash. Caught by surprise, Radical was unable to react in time. The wrench stayed up, frozen like a fly in lucite. Radical sprang forward, driven to attack by desperation, swinging his peace medallion at the back of the tree trunk neck below the helmet sweep. It connected with the chunk of an axe striking wood. Not as mighty a blow as the Lizard King could have delivered, not to be compared in the least with the terrible force of Grabowski's wrench, but sufficient to scramble Hardhat's senses, send him pitching face first into the grass and mud and crumpled signs. Radical poised above him, swinging his medallion in a slow circle at his side. A moment later, Douglas joined him, rubbing his side and grimacing.
"Think he cracked a few ribs there,"
he rasped in his familiar dirt road baritone.
"What the hell?"
Even as they watched, the inhumanly squat form of Hardhat dwindled into a stocky, balding man in baggy clothes, lying with his face in the mud, sobbing as if his heart were broken. Shaking his shaggy mane, Douglas turned to his benefactor.
"I'm Tom Douglas. Thanks for saving my ass."
"The pleasure's mine, man."
And then Douglas stepped forward and embraced the taller blonde man, and a cheer went up from the crowd. The National Guard soldiers were already in retreat, leaving their APC behind. The revolution would not come today, or ever, perhaps, but the kids had been saved. As the television cameras churned, Tom Douglas proclaimed radical his comrade in arms and called into being a celebration as wild as any the Bay Area had known. While the police kept their uneasy perimeter and the National Guard licked its wounds, thousands of kids poured into the park to hail the conquering heroes. The abandoned M113 provided an impromptu stage. Tents dotted the park like colorful mushrooms. Music and drugs and booze flowed freely, all that day and all that night. At the center of it all glowed Tom Douglas and his mysterious benefactor, surrounded by beautiful, compliant women. None more so than the willowy brunette with eyes like impacted ice everybody called Sunflower, who appeared to have sprouted from Radical's hip like a postnatal Siamese twin. The newcomer would give no other name than Radical, and he turned away all questions as to his origin and how he happened to be at that place at that time. With a grin and a shy,
"I was here because I was needed here, man."
At dawn the next day, he slipped quietly away from the dwindling festivities and vanished. He was never seen again. In the spring of 1971, charges against Tom Douglas stemming from the People's Park confrontation were dropped, at the recommendation of Dr. Tachyon, who'd been called in by Scare to help investigate the incident, just as Destiny's album City of Night hit the stands. Shortly thereafter, Douglas electrified the rock world by announcing he was retiring, not just as a musician, but as an ace. So he took Doc Tachyon's experimental trunk cure, and was one of the fortunate 30% on whom it worked. The Lizard King disappeared forever, leaving behind Thomas Marion Douglas, Norm, who was dead in 6 months. His overuse of drugs and alcohol had achieved such heroic proportions that only ace endurance kept him alive. Once that was gone, his health deteriorated rapidly. He died of pneumonia in a seedy hotel in Paris in the fall of 1971. As for Hardhat, interviewed by Dr. Tachyon the day after the confrontation, hospitalized for observation with a mild concussion, Wojtek Grabowski insisted his foes had not defeated him. "All you need is love," ran the received wisdom of the day, and love had brought him down, or so he claimed. Because when he hurled himself against the crowd, he found himself staring into the face of Anna, his wife, lost to him for 2 decades and a half. "Not quite Anna," he said tearfully. There were differences, in the color of hair, the shape of nose, and of course, Anna would not now be a woman in her early 20s. But their daughter would be. Grabowski was convinced he had seen at last the child he had never known. The horrible knowledge that his anger had almost led him to destroy that which he cherished most in all the world bled the strength from him in an instant, so that what Radical's medallion struck was a being in transition from full ace strength to a normal human state. Touched, Dr. Tachyon helped Grabowski search the Bay Area for his daughter. Privately, he never expected to find her. At the moment Grabowski believed he saw her, Tom Douglas had been recovering, his Lizard King aspect still active. And that black aura could make you see what you most wish to see. As far as Tachyon was concerned, it had. To none of his surprise, the search turned up nothing. In any event, he was able to devote little time to Grabowski, no matter how much the man's plight affected him. He returned east after 3 weeks of assisting Grabowski and Scare investigators. A couple of months later, he learned that Grabowski had vanished, no doubt to pursue the search for his family. Since then, no more had been heard of Wojtek Grabowski or Hardhat. And as for Radical, in the early morning hours of May 6, 1970, Mark Meadows staggered out of an alley opening into People's Park with his head full of white noise, clad only in his one pair of jeans. He had no memory of what had happened to him, scarcely realized where he was. He found himself amongst the remnants of last night's celebrants, heavy-eyed with fatigue but still chattering like speed freaks about the fantastic events of the last 24 hours.
"You should have been there, man,"
they told him. And as they described the events of yesterday morning, strange fragments of memory, surreal and disjointed, began to bubble to the surface of Mark's mind. Perhaps he had. Was he remembering his own experiences? Or was the last of the acid casting up images to match the breathless, vivid descriptions a dozen eyewitnesses pressed on him at once? He didn't know. All that he knew was that the radical represented the realization of his wildest dream, Mark Meadows as hero. And when he saw a sunflower standing nearby, hair disarrayed, eyes dreamy, and she said to him,
"Oh, Mark, I just met the most fantastic dude."
He knew that whatever hopes he'd had of being more than Sunflower's friend had just gone poof. Unless he were, in fact, the radical. He knew what to do, of course. He'd learn more than he consciously realized during his street apprenticeship with Sunflower. By nightfall, he was cross-legged on his own mattress, among his cookies and comic books, clutching 2 weeks' living expenses worth of LSD. He was so exalted when he popped the first tab that he barely needed the drug to get off. Which was all he did. No radical transformation. Nothing. He just tripped out. For a week, he didn't leave the apartment, living on moldy crumbs, slamming down increasing doses of acid as fast as the effects of the last charge faded. Nothing. When at last he staggered forth for more drugs, he'd already taken on a blur around the edges. So began the quest.